Bible, we'd count it a privilege to pass one on to you. Just raise your hand, and Rudy's going to scoot down the aisle there and make sure you have one. So if anybody needs one, raise your hand, and that way we can all study really long together. For all of us, Judges chapter 15 is where we left off. By way of review, I've told you to turn to chapter 15, but while you've got your hand in there, just real quick, jump back to chapter 13 for just a moment. Let's remind ourselves of where we are here. Chapter 13 begins, verse 1. Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So, as we arrive at chapter 15, they are still in that place of, because of rebellion, because they keep going through that cycle of falling away from the Lord and all, that they have now been delivered unto, and they are under the oppression, if you will, and all of the Philistines, which that, of course, sets the stage for the raising up of this next judge, Samson. If you look at verse 5 of chapter 13, it explains that. It tells that the Lord comes along and says, "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." And that Nazarite, of course, is Samson. And he will be, indeed, dedicated unto God from the womb. Last week in chapter 14, we saw that Samson had, he saw a woman of the Philistines, and he wanted her for his wife. He goes down as part of the feast and the festival and all, as they prepare to have this marriage and all. And he, as part of that, it tells us in chapter 14, he sets before the all the guys at the feast a riddle. But the guys successfully answer the riddle. They do that by obtaining the answer through Samson's brides, getting it from Samson and telling it to these guys. Well, that gets him angry. And thus, at the end of chapter 14, verse 19, it said, "And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle." Remember, he had made a sort of wager with them that if they could guess, he'd give them 30 changes of clothing and all, and so since they guessed it, he had to go get some clothing, so he goes and kills 30 of these men in Ashkelon, takes their clothing, pays the guys off, and says, "So his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man." That's where we pick up the story as we arrive at chapter 15. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the awesome time of worship tonight, the time of just gathering together and just sitting at your feet, just adoring you and praising you, Lord. Thank you. Thank you for these times of refreshing, Lord. And thank you that as we come to this time of looking to your word, that we know there's things you want to minister to in our lives, you want to speak to us, Lord. So, Lord, we ask you by your Spirit now to prepare our hearts. Lord, we recognize it might be something that's the exact point of the text. It might be something that you just use the text to, by your Spirit, maybe show us something else in our lives or something else you want to do or whatever it might be. Lord, whatever it is, we just want your way. So, Lord, help us. Help us not to be distracted by anything external or internal. And rather, Lord, help us just hear you now. Thank you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Chapter 15. After a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. He said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." But her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, "I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." Samson, after cooling off, heads back down to go back to get his wife. Father says, "Well, I thought you were just totally gone for good. I thought you hated her, so I gave her to the best man of your wedding." Father counters and says, "Why don't you take her younger sister? Isn't she better anyway?" He kind of points that out. Well, this does not go over too well with Samson. Verse 3, "And Samson said to them, 'This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them.' Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, He let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and olive groves. So he goes out and catches these foxes, a nifty little trick in itself, ties them together apparently by their tails, and puts a thing put on fire there, a torch, and he lets them go to run through all the fields, and as they're scrambling around, of course, they're dragging these torches around, setting everything on fire. Verse 6, and the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Interesting response. They come out and say, "Who burned up our field?" "Well, Samson did, because his father-in-law ripped him off." So they go to the father-in-law and burn him and the daughter. Kill them. Verse 7, Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I will seize." So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam. Apparently the term hip and thigh means he really went at it. After he learns that they actually, in response to him, said, "The field's on fire, go and kill the man, the father, and his daughter," he says, "Man, if you guys would do this, then I'm going to really get revenge on you." And he goes out, and it says he brings on a great slaughter against the Philistines. Samson's an interesting guy, isn't he? We looked at him this morning. We'll look a little more at him in just a moment, some other areas of his life. But Samson was set apart from the womb unto God, and yet he is a man who, he's got a lot of self and a lot of anger and revenge going on. And interesting. And the Lord did say he would use Samson to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And so, indeed, he's doing that. But interesting developments here. Verse 9. Now the Philistines went up, encamped in Judah, and deployed themselves against Lehi. The men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" So they answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourself." So they spoke to him, saying, "No, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you." And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. Philistines, in response to the hip and thigh slaughter that Samson had put upon the Philistines, they get their troops together and they go after him. And it turned out he's hiding in this place, this Etam, which is in the territory of Judah, where their tribe had settled. And so they show up on Judah's turf here, and the men of Judah ask, "Why you guys come out against us? What's going on?" And they go, "We've come here because we've come here to get Samson." Well, the men of Judah, they go out before the guys of Philistine, and they go over to Samson, and they basically say, "What are you doing? Don't you know what you're doing? What you're bringing down upon us?" And he goes, "Hey, what's he say? I've just done to them what they've done to me. I'm just giving them back for all they've given to me." And they say, "Well, we've got to arrest you." I mean, they're going to, they want to kind of appease the Philistines and all. So they say, "Well, we're going to take you and give you to them." And Samson says, "Okay, I'll go with you as long as you don't kill me." And they go, "No, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to tie you up and deliver you to the Philistines." So he goes for it. Verse 14. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. So when they bring him back, Philistines see him now, and they come running out. And they're all excited. They've got him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men." And so it was, when he had finished speaking, that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramoth Lehi. They're all excited. They've caught him. The Philistines are, and they come running out. They're gonna pounce on him and all. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and he thrashes the Philistines. Notice that when these exhibits of strength come along so often, it even specifically says it's the Spirit of the Lord that comes upon Samson. The long hair and all those things that are symbols of being a Nazarite are just that, symbols of being a Nazarite. But at the core of it all was a man set apart unto God, yielded to God. And it's that consecration, that dedication, that being set apart that is the source of strength for Samson. That's the root of this whole thing. It's the relationship with the Lord that gives Samson this strength. And he sees, he sees these guys come upon him. He breaks the bonds, grabs a jawbone, and commences to kill 1,000 of them with the jawbone of a donkey. And he names the place Ramoth Lehi. Perhaps some of you have a study Bible off to the side there somewhere. It tells you Ramoth Lehi means jawbone height. New name for a subdivision we're going to make. Buy a house out in Jawbone Heights. Now, I don't think it'd be popular. But he names the place that. Kills him with his jawbone. He throws it aside. And so he names basically his Jawbone Hill. Jawbone Height. And that name stuck. Verse 18. Then he became very thirsty. So he cried out to the Lord. And here we read the first prayer. And only one of two prayers, really. The other one will be at the end of Samson's life. But here we read this first prayer. So he cried out to the Lord and said, "You have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall in the hand of the uncircumcised?" So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore he called its name En-Hakkor, which is in Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistine. Here we read Samson's prayer. What's the focus of his prayer? Pretty straightforward. Lord, after all his hard work, you can let me die of thirst. So the Lord gives him water. And says Samson goes on to judge for 20 years. Now I reach chapter 16, story of Samson and Delilah, a well-known passage. And yet, again, I just encourage us, don't let familiarity turn us off or kind of lull us from learning from it, because it's very, very important lessons in here. Chapter 16 now. Now, Samson went to Gaza. Gaza, of course, is Philistine territory. That's home turf for them. It's where Gaza is today. It's on that, what we'd call the western southern border of Israel, down there along the Mediterranean, kind of a coastal area down towards the south. Everybody pretty much knows because of the turmoil today where the Gaza Strip and everything is. It's that same area. So Samson goes down to, basically, he goes down to a Philistine city. He goes down to the enemy's territory. Samson went down to Gaza, and of course he's not there just to sightsee. It says he saw a harlot there, and he went in to her. When the Gazites were told, "Samson has come here," they surrounded the place and lay wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, "In the morning, when it's daylight, we will kill him." And Samson lay low till midnight. Then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. He goes to a place he shouldn't go. Goes into a woman he should not be going into. In other words, involved in relationships he shouldn't, in places he shouldn't, doing activities he shouldn't. And we're going to see the dominoes begin to fall through this chapter in particular. But he gets there. And anyway, the Philistines go, "Whoa, he's here. The guy's been killing so many of our guys. He's here right in the city. Let's lay in wait." So they get outside the city and they're going to pounce on him in the morning. Well, he doesn't wait till morning. About midnight, he comes out. Now, Samson being Samson, he doesn't just like sneak out of town. He goes over the city gates and rips them out, doorposts and all. And he carries them. Carries them, it says, to a hill that faces Hebron. Hebron is about 11 miles from this area of Gaza. He didn't just kind of drag it across the street. He just took it a long ways away and chucked it. Verse 4. Afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Entice him, and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver." So now we meet Delilah, a name that's kind of become synonymous, of course, over the years with a woman who is conniving and that kind of idea, at least in terms of this story. He falls in love with this woman. Again, he's in a place he shouldn't be, and getting into a relationship with someone that he shouldn't. The leaders of the Philistines see this, and they come to her, and they enlist her aid in trying to conquer Samson. He's in the enemy's turf. The enemy's not going to just stop there. The enemy's going to try to use the occasion to trip him up. And, of course, we need to learn from these analogies. We need to learn from it. These are written for our benefit. When you're where you shouldn't be, when you're involved in relationships you can be involved in, sure enough, the enemy, of course, is going to be right there to try to get you to compromise, try to trip you up and snare you. And of course, she's going to go along with this agreement. So we read in verse 6, "So Delilah said to Samson, 'Please tell me where your great strength lies, and with what you may be bound to afflict you.' And Samson said to her, 'If they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man.' So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, and she bound him with them. Now men were lying in wait, staying with her in the room, and she said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not known." So, attempt number one of Delilah to find out Samson's source of strength, that he might be conquered, might try to bring him down, it fails. Of course, she tells the Philistines this answer, but it's not the truthful answer. And when they attempt to take him, he just breaks them with no problem. Here comes attempt number two, verse 10. "Then Delilah said to Samson, 'Look, you've mocked me and told me lies.'" Like she's being like totally upright and honest here herself, right? "But look, you've mocked me and told me lies. Now please tell me what you may be bound with." So he said to her, "They bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used. Then I shall become weak and be like any other man." Therefore Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And men were lying in wait, staying in the room. But he broke them off his arms like a thread. So effort number two results in the same thing. He has no problem escaping from this. Third attempt, verse 13. "Delilah said to Samson, 'Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me what you may be bound with.' He said to her, 'If you weave the 7 locks of my head into the web of the loom.' So she wove it tightly with the batten of the loom and said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' But he awoke from his sleep and pulled out the batten and the web from the loom." So here he says, "No, here's the real reason. You just got to weave my hair together into the loom." And so she does that while he's asleep, but it doesn't stop him. Was Samson just playing a game here? Is he like really that dumb? Let's see. She asked me what I can be bound with and conquered with. I go to sleep. I wake up. It's happened to me. I wonder if there's any connection between her and what's happening to me. We can become so spiritually blind. But let's say it's not that angle. Let's say he knows, because it kind of sounds like it, doesn't it? Because he goes, "Well, you know, if they bind me securely with ropes," so like he's talking about, he knows that this is efforts being, it's like he's playing with it, because see, he thinks he's strong enough. He thinks he can handle it. He's in the enemy's turf, in a relationship he shouldn't be, but now he's even going that next step of playing with these things, so to speak. He's just kind of playing with the enemy. "Oh, no big deal. I can handle the temptation. I can handle the things thrown at me. I'm strong enough." So whether he just isn't getting it, or if he does get it, but he just doesn't see the threat, if he thinks he can just, if he's just toying with the whole thing, I don't know. But now we read in verse 15. "Then she said to him, 'How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You've mocked me these 3 times and have not told me where your great strength lies.' And it came to pass, when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him, so that his soul was vexed to death, that he told her all his heart and said to her, No razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. At this point, Delilah perceives that Samson has indeed told the truth. I mean, she pressures him. She keeps at him here. Interesting. How can you say you love me when your heart is not with me? Her actions have been totally loving, of course. I'm saying that facetiously. But and again, he seems to, you know, he goes, because he comes out and says, but you've mocked me three times here. Basically, kind of, I mean, he sees where it's coming from, but he keeps going with this thing. But now he kind of comes out and he tells her what's really going on for the pressure she puts on and all. He finally says, basically, what's he saying? I'm set apart unto God, and this is a sign of that. Well, you see, as his hair is being shaved, he's also been compromising. He's been making decisions that don't represent being set apart, being dedicated. And so, while the physical shaving is going on, there is that spiritual compromising that's been taking place. And so in a moment we're going to read the horrible outcome of it. But the point to all this is beware of compromises in our lives. Beware of situations and relationships and all that won't get us anywhere good. Verse 18, when Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, Come up once more, for he has told me all his heart. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees. How often has a person been ensnared as they've been lulled into a sort of spiritual sleep at the knees of some compromising position, something they're into, whatever it might be. And called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, The Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he awoke from his sleep and said, I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free. And how very sad this next sentence is. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. She perceives Samson's told the truth. She now summons the Philistines. They come up. Indeed, his head is now shaved. And when she says, the Philistines are upon you, he awakes and he thinks, I'll just tackle it like I've always have done. I've handled it before. I can handle it again. I'll get the victory this time just like before. No sweat. No problem. But then we read, but he didn't know that the Lord had departed from him. His strength had departed from him. Again, hopefully we see the example there. Spiritually speaking, we compromise, we get in a place in things we shouldn't, and we get to that place of distance and don't recognize what's gone on. You see, it's possible for a person to get to the place that they lose the strength, the closeness, the wisdom, the sense of God's presence, and not even be aware of it. I'm not talking about losing your salvation. Thank God that when he comes in, and he's in. But I'm talking about just losing that strength and all that comes from leaning on him and looking to him and yielding to him and surrendering to him and all that's involved in that, having his armor on and everything. And you can get to that place where you don't even realize you've drifted from that. You can compromise yourself into the place of distance from God and not even be aware of it. Until the Philistines are upon you. Until the trial comes along. The temptation is there. Hey, you handled it all along. I can handle it this time. But then down you go. Because you got to the point where you were trusting in yourself. Were relying on your own methods or strength or whatever you thought was getting you through. Your own wisdom, whatever it is. But you found it wasn't enough. Samson thought he could go out as before. As he says, he goes, oh, no big deal. I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free. But he did not know the Lord had departed from him. When you are close to someone, you know when you haven't had time with them for a while, don't you? If you have a close friend, but you haven't talked to him for a while, what do? You call him up, you catch him, you go, where you been? I've missed you. I haven't talked to you. Or your mate. Sometimes you'll get, you know, if you guys are married, you might see your mate, gosh, we haven't touched base for a while. Let's go have dinner and talk, or let's go on a date night or something. Let's just take a walk and talk. And it's been, you know, we sense the distance. When you have a closeness, you sense the distance. But if you don't look out, if you just step by step drift and you start allowing it, you start settling for it, you settle for distance, it's like you hardly don't miss it almost. It's like you don't realize where you've drifted to, the distance that's gotten between you and that other person or whatever. Same with the Lord. If we don't spend time with him, if we don't spend time in prayer and just listening throughout the day, have a sense of his presence, looking for his hand at work, spending time in the word or whatever it might be, you just kind of, little by little, get to that place where, you know, you haven't spent time. Sometimes for days might go or longer. And because we've settled, it's almost like, well, that's okay. Then all of a sudden along comes something, that trial, that circumstance, that pressure. Oh, I'll just rise up before. Like before. But there's not that you haven't had your armor on. And sure enough, the enemy's arrow finds a target. And we get tripped up. But we didn't even know it until all of a sudden, whoosh, the arrow stuck. He thought he could go out, but he was just a sitting duck because he was going out in his own strength. And what a sad thing it is. Remember, his long hair simply represented dedication to God. Samson was supposed to be a set-apart man unto God and was supposed to live like it. But he wasn't. He wasn't living it out. He was playing around where he shouldn't have been, doing things he shouldn't have, using methods of compromise and all. And that got him to the place where the Lord had departed. There was a distance there, and he didn't even know it. What a sad place to be. We covered this section of Scripture this morning. I encourage you to get the tape if you want to dive more into it, because it's an important encouragement and warning, an exhortation to us. Again, not that we lose our salvation, but we can get to that place through compromise and all, where we're sitting ducks. That's the negative side of this whole thing. The positive side of it is we get to be close to the Lord. We get to experience his plan in our lives. Samson is a saved soul, but he lived a wasted life in so many ways. He settled for plan B. Let's not let that be us. Instead, let's make sure we're tracking in plan A. That we're right in the center of God's will. The awesome thing is we get to. I get to experience his leading and guidance and encouragement and protection. I have all of his resources, his promises, his peace, his joy, his hope. What does Samson ever find out there? In Gaza, in the enemy's territory, in those other relationships. What do you ever find that ever really met the need? Nothing but deceit and lies. And as we're going to see in a minute, it's going to pull him down and leave him in captivity. And it's going to blind him and everything else. Nothing good out there. And we got to learn that lesson. But the positive thing, the awesome thing is I don't have to look around me anymore. I can look up. And that's one thing when the Lord got a hold of me. One thing he spoke to me about was that he has that plan for our lives. And we can experience it step by step. Nothing better than walking right in the center of his will. Plan A. Seek it, walk in it. Verse 21. Then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. His eyes are put out by his enemies. Physical blindness followed his spiritual blindness. He's bound with brass fetters. Brass is always a symbol in Scripture of judgment, meaning Samson is suffering now the consequences of his choices, and it's not a pretty sight. He now is just a grinder in the prison, blinded, got chains, Probably you can picture it. You can hear the sounds, those chains clunk along behind him. He's blind. Think about it. One who was set apart to God, now just grinding away in the prison. Samson's life is just a total picture of what compromise and sin will do to a life. He's brought so very low, blinded to the truth. Life has become a grind. And that's how it is for so many people, settling for far less than God's best. A saved soul, but a wasted life. How sad it is to see the toll that sin and all takes upon a life. Don't ever buy the enemy's lie that there's something you need in the enemy's temptations to you. Verse 22, however, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. And remember that his strength was his commitment to the Lord. His shaved head signified the breaking of a vow. It signified the compromise that had come into Samson's life. He made a commitment. He was supposed to be dedicated to the Lord. When he broke the commitment, his strength left him. But here it begins to grow again. God's grace is extended to Samson. He began to look up in the midst of his situation. And yes, God will go on to use Samson. We'll read that in just a moment. I'm not making light of that. God said he would use Samson to begin to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines. And he does do that. God fulfills that. But it's going to come about in a way that's not the way it could have been. God's going to redeem the situation, but Samson's going to wind up bringing down the house, literally, on himself also. Let's read it. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead. Dagon, of course, is a false god. Dagon is a fish god. He has half the body of a man and half the body of a fish. And they worship this god with a little g, false god. But notice what Samson's compromising all actually does here also. You know, later on we're going to read, I think it's with David, and as he's confronted with his sin and all, and the part of the confrontation is, you know, you've given the enemies of God an occasion to blaspheme God. And you see that. Same idea here. Dagon didn't deliver Samson. Dagon's not even real. Samson did this because he wasn't following the real God, because he'd compromised. But it gave the enemies of God an occasion to speak poorly of the Lord and to misdirect praise to this false god. How often the sin of a believer will do that, will cause the enemies of God to speak poorly of him or to think their circumstances are due to some other reason and add to their being led astray. Truth is, Samson's in the state because of his own sin and unfaithfulness. So it happened. When their hearts were merry, that they said, call for Samson, that he may perform for us. So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them, and they stationed him between the pillars. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple, so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof, watching while Samson performed. Then Samson called to the Lord, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may, with one blow, take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. Now we hear this second and last prayer of Samson. He prays for strength. He says, Lord, just one more time. And Samson took hold, verse 29, of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. Then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. And his brothers and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of his father Manoah. He had judged Israel 20 years. So God does use him in this last act here, gives him back this strength. But of course it brings down the house upon him as well as the Philistines. A sad ending. Again, it didn't have to be this way. Tremendous potential, yet he fell so short. Called by God from the womb, yet it was so much about himself for a good part of his life. A wasted life. Of course, this story repeats itself today all the time. There are those who have so much potential. Indeed, every believer has a plan. God has a plan for their life. And there's giftings God wants to give. And we're endowed by God with so many gifts. Natural giftings, but even more so supernatural giftings. And how sad to waste our lives, to not seek and walk in His will and those things He has for us. Time and again, people come back after stepping out and risking it and going for it. And just rejoicing and saying, I didn't know. Until I got to that place of surrender, I got to that place of yielding, I got in that place of tracking with what He says, of listening and obeying, and discovering plan A is the best thing around. A believer not in sync with God is a sad thing. It's like a parent who looks at their child and sees their child doing something that's destructive and hurting so much for the child. And God in His love is not down on us when we're over there in plan B, but it's a sad thing. But a believer in plan A, in God's perfect will, a beautiful thing. And God can do awesome things in a life surrendered to Him. Chapter 17. Let me just mention this. These chapters from here on out to the end of Judges give us an insight into this period of Israel's history. In just a moment, we're going to read verse 6, where it says, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That is a key verse for this entire book. It was a period of time between Joshua and all and between God raises up kings for Israel where every man did what was right in his own eyes. Therefore, we're going to see it's a very confused time, a very rebellious time, a very idolatrous time. Indeed, that's what Judges has been much about, hasn't it? As we've studied that cycle over and over again. These ending chapters here are not really in chronological order. They are more like an appendix that's going to add some information on this time of the judges. And you'll see what we mean as we go along here. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me. I took it. And his mother said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my son. Kind of jumped right in the middle of that story, didn't we? You go, wait a minute, what money or anything? Well, it just jumps right in there and tells us this. We meet a guy named Micah. Turned out his mother apparently lost some money or had some money stolen from her. She puts a curse on anybody who took it, says he hears this, and he goes, hey, Mom, I took it. Here it is. So she goes, oh, well, then bless you. So he goes from curse to blessing in one verse there. Verse 3, so when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now therefore I will return it to you. Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. The man Micah had a shrine, and made an ephod and household idols. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So again, the story flows here now. The mother says, well, you know, this money you've returned to me, I set that aside because I was going to have some images carved out and everything for you, son. So she indeed does do that. They turn over the silversmith. He carves out some false idols here and all, sets them up in his home. There's this ephod and household idols. Takes one of his sons and makes him a priest. Basically, I mean, much of this, of course, is strictly forbidden by the law. But the point is, it just shows that they were living in a confused, rebellious, idolatrous time. Micah sets up these images in his home, and then we read in verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that is a key verse for this book. It explains why Micah is doing what he does, and what we're going to read as we press on here. It's because he's doing what is right in his own sight. And notice it says, everyone did what was right in his own sight. Thus, it was a time of spiritual confusion. What's wrong with the man doing what's right in his own sight? Well, when a man gets in the driver's seat, and I mean that generically, ladies, men or women, when a person gets in the driver's seat of their own life, there will be a ditch in your future. There just will be. We might like to think, oh no, man is basically good. He can get along with each other and he'll make right decisions. Wrong. And this verse just reveals the spiritual condition of Israel, and this book of Judges shows us the outcome of that. The continual falling away and getting into idolatry and this rebellion and all those things. Everyone doing what was right in their sight. But let me just pause for a moment and say that, is it really any different today in terms of this world? Certainly there are many people who advocate this approach. Do your own thing. Hey, what's right for you may not be right for me. I got to do what's right for me. But there needs to be final authority. It can't be just us all doing whatever we think is right. Yet so many live that way today. You can jump out of a window and say, hey, gravity's fine for you, but I don't want to go by it. I don't need to live by gravity just because you do. If you want to follow the law of gravity, you go ahead. You know, to each their own. But I'm not going to go by gravity. I'm going to jump out the window, but I'm not going to go by that law. You can do that, but you'll still have an appointment with the ground. You see, there are absolutes. God tells us the way it is, and he tells us for our good. I remember a while back hearing a discussion between some politicians or somebody, and they were kind of coming at that way. Well, you know, it may not be right for you. And it was interesting because I found myself saying, but, you know, kind of, you know, you maybe think about what they're saying. And I'm going, but you're not the final authority, you guys. You don't just get to pick and choose what is. There is a final authority. There are absolutes. There is a heaven. There is a hell. Well, I don't believe there's a hell. Well, that doesn't change it. It's like gravity. It's not going to change it. Jesus really is the way. But it's open to all. And we don't get to change the Bible. And we don't get to change its meaning. Well, I think it means this, or I think that, or, oh, okay. You know, well, that's what you want to think. No, it's not like that. This is clear enough that anybody who looks at it and studies it will certainly understand the basic principles for salvation. And you can't change it. To add to the Bible, to change the Bible, to discount parts of the Bible, to do that will lead anybody who does that and anybody who follows them into real trouble. To do what is right in our own sight is very dangerous. Because we don't see clearly. We don't see accurately. I don't see around the next corner. Anybody here, anybody see tomorrow? You don't see tomorrow. But God does. And His love, He says, go this way. And it'll get you where you want to go. So everyone was doing was right in their own sight. Verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim to the house of Micah as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? So he said to him, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to stay. Micah said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as priest. Interesting. So it inserts here now a young man that we're going to read more about in the next chapter. This young man heads out from Bethlehem looking for a place to stay, meets Micah. Micah goes, where are you going? Well, I'm looking for a place to stay. Well, come in here. And basically, he hires him now to be his family priest. And we see his motive here. Basically, his motive is he gets blessings. He goes, now I know that God's going to be good to me because I've hired this Levite priest. We're going to tackle 18. Let's just read the story, and it's going to flow from what we just read. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtol, to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, go search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim to the house of Micah and lodged there. So what's going on? The tribe of Dan had been given an area, like with all the tribes. However, the area they were at, there were Philistines occupying the land. And Dan had a great trouble dislodging them. And so the tribe of Dan was crammed into a little teeny area. They're cramped in a little area. So they say, look, let's find someplace else to dwell. So they tell these men to head out and go looking. Well, they head up north to the mountains of Ephraim, and sure enough, they show at Micah's house, where we just read about in the last chapter. So now they show up at Micah's, verse 3. While they were there at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Remember the Levite that he just hired as a priest? Well, these guys from the tribe of Dan, they hear him, and they recognize the voice of this guy. They turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? He said to them, thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. So they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we will go will be prosperous. And the priest said to them, go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. So they hear this young man. They find out, what are you doing here? Hey, I'm a priest now. I got hired by Micah here. And they go, well, ask the Lord for us. Are we going to have success on our journey? And he goes, yes, the Lord's going to be with you. Verse 7. So the 5 men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything, for they were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. Then the spies came back to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtol, and their brethren said to them, what is your report? So they said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go out, to go and enter to possess the land. When you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land. For God has given it into our hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. So what has happened here? They go to this area that's in the very northern part of modern Israel. At this time, it's called a city by the name of Laish. They go there, and they're kind of out. They're kind of remote. And as these spies check it out, they go, hey, this is great. They're really not aligned with anybody, so there's no one that's going to come protect them when we attack. They're kind of just this rural community here, but they got a beautiful land. And indeed, for those that are going to go to Israel here in another week or two, or if you ever go, we go up the northern country, we're going to visit this very city, or the remnants of it, the tell there, and you'll see it's a beautiful area. And they see that, and they go back home, and they go, let's go for it, you guys. These guys are not protected that well, and we can go in there and take it. They head up there. By the way, after the tribe of Dan does indeed go up and conquer the town of Laish, it will be renamed the city of Dan. And that's why from now on, There's going to be times when people describe the land of Israel in the Old Testament, like they'll talk about something that covered the whole land, they'll say what? That it was from Dan to Beersheba. Beersheba is in the very southern part. Dan, Laish, it's going to be renamed Dan, is a city in the very north. And so it kind of becomes symbolic of the entire area of Israel. You'll hear that phrase, from Dan to Beersheba. So these guys go back. They say, let's go for it. So verse 11, and 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtol, armed with weapons of war. They went up and encamped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore, they call that place Manahah Dan to this day. There it is, west of Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So now they're on their way. 600 men are going up to take the territory up there by Laish, and they stop at Micah's house. Now watch what happens here. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore, consider what you should do. So they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, what are you doing? So we get the picture. They show up in this land, and the five guys that are there before said to the rest of these 600 guys, hey, do you guys know there's a guy over here that he's like a priest? He's got all these idols and everything else going on. What do you think? And they go, let's go check it out. Let's go over there. So they go over there, and they actually go into the house now of Micah, and they take. They steal these things, these idols and all. They go in there and take these images and all. Well, the priest sees this, and he says, what are you doing? And they said to him, be quiet, and put your hand over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the house of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? So the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod, the household idols, and the carved image, and took his place among the people. And they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. So basically, I guess it's still trading season. The trading deadline hasn't happened yet. And they come in and they go, hey, man, make you a deal. Right here, you're just a priest of one household. Come with us, you'll be the priest of a whole tribe. And says the young man, priest thinks about it, and he says, his heart's glad. Hey, cool deal. So he grabs all the idols and everything, and off he goes. He's going to be the priest now of the tribe of Dan as they settle up here by Laish. As they head out, though, notice it says, as they head out, interesting, they're heading away. And what they do is they put the little ones, the livestock, and goods in front of them. Why might they do that? Because they know in a minute Micah is not going to be a happy camper, and they're about to be attacked from behind. And so they put all the young ones up front, actually, instead of maybe trailing behind normally. They go, uh-oh, good chance we're going to hear about this one. So they put all the young ones out front. And sure enough, verse 22, when they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, what ails you that you have gathered such a company? So what happens? Dan and his neighbors gather together. They take off. See, not Dan. Micah and his neighbors gather together, take off after these guys that are from the tribe of Dan, catch up with them. These guys, these warriors and all from the tribe of Dan, turn around and they see Micah and these guys and they go, what's wrong? How can you come after us? Verse 24, so he said, you've taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you've gone away. Now what more do I have? How can you say to me what ails you? So they go, what are you after? He goes, what do you mean, what are you after? You stole my god. Pretty sad to have a god somebody can steal, huh? But as he said, you stole my gods. I want my gods back. He said, how can you say what's wrong with me? So what do they say to him? Verse 25, and the children of Dan said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us, excuse me, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household. Then the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, He turned and went back to his house. Basically, they say what? Mike and his friends catch up to the tribe of Dan and go, "Hey, you took my gods, man. We want them back." And they basically turn on and they go, "Hey, you don't want to be messing with us." Basically, that's what they say to him. "Hey, you don't want to do that. You could lose your life over this thing. Don't let your anger even be heard amongst us. Basically, say, you really want to fight with us? You could lose your life over this whole thing. Do you really want to do that?" So Micah, realizing that it says they were too strong for him, he turns around and heads back home. Remember, this is a time what? When every man does what is right in his own sight. It's not like there's some governing king or rule or law or authority going on. They're just doing their own thing. In this case, the stronger prevails. So this whole interaction between the tribe of Dan and Mike and his neighbors is about men, people, doing what is right in their own eyes. That's why it resembles the way the world does business so often today. This little interaction is a lot like, if you look at it, the stronger prevailing, who can get the best of each other, who can get the position on each other. That's what the world does because people are doing what is right in their own sight. Let's finish out the chapter. Verse 27. So they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure. And they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. So they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. So the tribe of Dan now takes over the city of Laish. Becomes the city of Dan, as I mentioned earlier. And today you can visit Tel Dan, it's called. Over in Israel, there's so many times where cities have been destroyed and built upon and destroyed and built upon layers of civilization that you get these things that look like big hills. Well, they're not hills, they're actually remnants of cities, and they're called tells. And you can go visit Tel Dan. And they've actually excavated the Tel Dan. Those who are going to us, going with us to Israel, or again, if you ever have a chance to go, Lord willing, it's on our itinerary, we'll be visiting Tel Dan. And you can go there and see this area. And see what they've excavated much of it. Matter of fact, they've excavated down to, they found a gate that is dated back to the time of Abraham. See, Abraham had visited Laish when it was still Laish. And they've actually found a gate that they believe Abraham probably, because of its location, all walked right through that very gate. Well, the point is, as Dan settles here, they brought their idols with them, their idol worship and all. And so this area will go on to be an area of idol worship. Just as a sidelight real quick, later on, when the northern kingdom of Israel separates, splits from the southern kingdom, when Jeroboam establishes the 10 tribes in the northern kingdom, which the city of Dan and all will be part of, Jeroboam is going to be fearful that if the people go down to the temple in Jerusalem, which by then will have been relocated from Shiloh to Jerusalem, Jeroboam's concerned if they go from there down to Jerusalem to worship that their hearts might be drawn back to the southern kingdom and all. So he's going to set up idol worship, a calf worship, a golden calf in Dan, and tell the people, hey, just worship there, and it will become a center of idolatry. And again, you can go visit that site even today. Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. It's a confused, idolatrous time for Israel. Here they set up these carved images. Well, the actual tabernacle down in Shiloh, they set up these images here in Dan, and it will be there until the time that they're taken into captivity and all. Like I say, it'll become a center of idolatrous worship. Overall, this whole section, as I say, just kind of amplifies what a sad time it is for Israel. The results that have come about is they've forsaken the Lord, not walked in his ways. It's a time of everybody doing their own thing, and they suffer for it greatly. We see that over and over again. Always let God have the driver's seat. When we do things our own way, we will suffer for it. But we yield his way, and there's blessing and peace and joy and purpose and all. You see, there is a truth. Not a truth, there is the truth. There is the way, there is the life, and it's in Jesus. Do it His way. We've used up our time. Let's stand. You've been great Bible students. We covered a big hunk of Scripture tonight.